Good morning and welcome to our last day of oral arguments for this fiscal year. We have two cases set for oral argument this morning and then several others that will be submitted without argument. Your panel today is to my left, Justice Dabney Basil, and to my right, Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Lee Gabriel. So we are ready to proceed if the clerk will call the first case, please. All right, Ms. Bauman.
Morning.
Morning.
I want to focus on three issues that we presented in our brief. The first one being issues related to the e-jury. The second one being that there was factually insufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that Dr. Pompa provided emergency medical care. And the third being that there was insufficient evidence to support the jury's finding that Dr. Weatherall did not render care with willful and wanton negligence. Starting with the e-jury issue, as we focused on in our brief, I think the key case here is the Mendoza case, which came out of this court in 1988. In that case, this court reversed and remanded because there were a disproportionate number of jurors on that jury who were teachers. And that resulted because the system was to draw jurors from the transfer list who had postponed their initial service. And the court found, and I quote, "Every citizen is entitled to a fair and impartial trial before an impartial jury, fairly representative of the community." And then I'm paraphrasing, because of the process that was used in that case, the jury was not a randomly selected cross-section of the community. Because of that, the court reversed and sent it back for a new trial. The same situation happened here. The system that was used resulted in 100% of the jurors in this case having daily access to the internet-enabled devices. That is not representative of the community as a whole, because it represents a different demographic. We presented at the trial court level multiple times and on appeal the Pew Research Center study, which found a statistically significant difference between people who have daily access to the internet with these various devices and people who do not. It found statistically significant differences in terms of if you make that distinction for your jury, you'll have too many people who are younger, more affluent, more educated, and more Caucasian. And we presented the statistics to the trial court below, including the fact that Tarrant County is approximately 50%, it's 49.8% white, but the panel from which the jury was selected in this case was 77% white, and the panel jury was 66% white. There were other statistics presented, that's just an example. And I do want to point out, with respect to this issue and several others, the appellant presented new studies and new data that was not presented to the trial court below and shouldn't be considered by this court. As an example, they cite census data on computer access on page 65, footnote 2. They also presented information about why jurors don't show up on pages 66 and 67 and cited an SMU Law Review article and news articles on pages 75 and 76. None of that was presented to the trial court, and so it's improper for this court to consider that.
But their argument is your data is not sufficiently targeted on Tarrant County. How do you respond to that?
Our data, I would say, first of all, that if you look at the Mendoza case, this court held that you can't put an unreasonable proof requirement on proving that it places impractical burden on the party, that they cite the Ligon case, in re Ligon, from the Beaumont Court of Appeals. And in that case, one of the the party tried to do what they're suggesting. That case, the court, they went out and said, well, we need to get information on the composition of the group as a whole of potential jurors so we can prove that there's a difference, right? And that court said, well, you're not allowed to. The trial court allowed that information. The appellate court on mandamus said, no, you can't have that information because information regarding race and other information regarding potential jurors is private and protected. So I think what you have is what they're suggesting places an impossible burden on proving that we got a jury here that wasn't representative. So what you have in Mendoza is a situation where no statistics were provided about the number of jurors. The court was able to make a common sense determination that if you have this many teachers, right, that is not representative. And so I think here is similar. We've presented statistics nationally that show that there's a difference in these two groups. Then you can look at what happened with this panel, and you can look at what happened with this jury, and see, and in fact, what was predicted nationally happened here.
But Mendoza was specific to Tarrant County. There was testimony from Weta Stevens, from the district clerk, concerning what their actual practice was, and the citation to the Teal decision of the United States Supreme Court talks about systematic discrimination, if you will, systematic exclusion when it comes to cross-reference. In fact, the Teal case is talking specifically about low-income dock workers and that type of thing. And the court said the only problem constitutionally there was it was systematic and it was 100% exclusion of all of those. And there was evidence in the Teal case that, in fact, from the clerk themselves, that's what they did. In fact, the clerk said specifically, somebody's making $4 an hour, $10 an hour, I'm not gonna bring them here because they're only gonna make $4 an hour and they'll never serve. So I'm not gonna waste my time to do that. And the court said because that was systematic, that was a violation of the Constitution. But the court also specifically said that merely doing that on an occasional basis, if it was done randomly, it didn't run afoul of the Constitution. So where's the problem with the randomness, and what's your evidence with regard to why the system used here it meets the Teal standard as opposed to just some discussion that, well, we're not getting the jury that we want?
Sure. I think the systematic issue is the system that's in place is 100%. I mean, it's the nature of the system. It's very simple. 100% of the jurors were required to have daily internet access. So when you make that distinction between a group of people who have the means, the money, and whatnot to have daily internet access versus those that don't, that's the systematic problem. And I think there's a really simple and easy solution, and it was raised below by the appellee.
But is that not a self-selection situation? Because every one of those jurors is making a phone call or accessing by the internet on their own basis. They do, in fact, have the option based upon what's sent to them in terms of summons to come down here if they want to. So it's a self-selection situation in terms of how they're ending up in the jury pool.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Self-selection, except that not for people who don't have daily internet access, right?
But there are people who have daily internet access that may use the other system. Like, I would do that. I have daily internet access, but I would probably use the other system, let's just say. So you haven't, it's not 100%. Of people who have daily internet access that are in that group. There are some of that group that may be in the other group.
But in the other group, we know it's 100. We know that at somebody who doesn't have daily internet access necessarily is going to be in the other group, and that there's a difference between people who don't have internet access and people who do.
So what evidence do you have about the Tarrant County jury pool with regard to this specific how this specific jury was selected? Are we, Mendoza, again, we had specific evidence with regard to specific systematic selection by the county as opposed to self-selection under the circumstances. What makes your jury in this particular case a jury that was not selected randomly?
Because the trial court made the decision that only people who have daily internet access would be on the jury, that it would be 100% people who have that access. Now, some people have that access might be in the other pool, but 100% of the people who are going to be on this jury with a plaintiff who was poor and African-American, 100% of the people on this jury were going to be people who had daily internet access. And that was a decision made by the trial court in this case. So, by the way, the objection that was raised by counsel, by Appellee's counsel, was appropriate to the trial court because it was a trial court's decision to go with 100% people with internet access. And I want to point out that in Appellant's brief, they actually admitted that there's a disparity between the two groups. And I'm going to quote from page 70. The result, and they're referring to if the traditional or the non-e-jury panel had been chosen, quote, the result would be the mere opposite of what Campbell views as the problem under the e-jury system. The result would be a disparity that just changes the groups with the under and over representation problems. I'm going to say there is a simple, easy fix. If on that day, and you had the potential, the group of potential jurors, a hypothetical 1,000 people were coming in, and if 60% responded to the e-jury and 40% end up in the central jury room, well, then you can just pick a pool, and you have 100% on your panel, right? You'd have 60 from the e-jury and 40 from the central jury room. That way, it's random. You have the same amount proportionally to how the population as a whole responded. But we don't have that here. We have a population of people who have access and a population of people who don't. And you know the people who don't are all in that central jury room, and zero of them had the opportunity to be on the panel and to be on this jury.
We have no idea what their demographics are.
Well, there, you know,
you have no evidence of what their demographics are.
If that's the required standard, though, that's an impossible standard to meet, and that's what the.
But the flip side is any disparity becomes no cross section, and we never get a jury picked. In other words, you need to be able to tell us how we actually determine what is systematic to the point where randomness, which is what's required by the Constitution. Okay, you're not entitled to a perfect cross-section. You're entitled to random selection. How do we make that determination? Your argument is essentially, we just show it's not a cross-section, bingo, we win under Mendoza. Mendoza doesn't actually say that. It says in this particular instance, it's clearly not a cross-section because you've got 10 teachers out of 20 potential jurors.
The answer is it's, I think the problem is with the system, okay? Not necessarily. I think to prove that there was a difference between the two groups, we'd have to get into the personal private information. But if you back up and you look at the system of selection, the system guarantees that you are not going to have a fair cross-section because you've excluded from the group of potential jurors for this plaintiff anyone who doesn't have daily internet access. And so we know that nationally, and there's no reason it wouldn't apply to Tarrant County, people who don't have daily internet access are poorer, less, older, and tend to be less Caucasian.
Do we get to take into account the fact that there's some idea that if you can get people to actually respond, that they're more likely to actually show up for jury duty because they're in fact responding to a specific court? They don't know that they're just going down into the bowels of the court's system to figure out at some point in time 5 years later whether they'll get picked.
That's the stated interest for using the e-jury system. There's no reason not to use the e-jury system. You are proportionate. So if 60% of the potential jurors that week were e-jury and 40% weren't, then you just mix your pool for that case 60-40. So you still have the incentive. You still can use the e-jury system. It's just the 100% or 0% creates you don't have a fair cross-section at that point because you've put something into that mix, into that selection process that changes the mix. And it changes the mix to the detriment of a poor African-American woman who's just looking for a fair cross-mix for her jury pool.
And that's the remedy you want us to impose in our opinion, to say that the clerk is supposed to determine what the mix is between the e-jury and the regular jury, and then mix the jury in those proportions?
It's how many people, in your jury pool, they would know in any given week, how many people in the jury pool responded by the e-jury and how many didn't, right? And so if it's 60-40, then for any given pool, it would be 60-40. That way it ensures randomness, right? If it's 75-25, it would be 75-25. But at least you're not imposing this arbitrary distinction to where you either have a jury who 100% has daily internet access or a large percentage, all of the people who don't are in the other room. That is arbitrary. It's not representative of the community as a whole. So it's a systematic problem that results in a bias. And it's admitted in the appellant's papers. Am I out of time?
Your light will turn red when you're out of time.
Okay, thank you. I want to point out that on the socioeconomic status issue presented, obviously in Mendoza, that was a teacher issue, right? So there wasn't, this court in that case said if you have too many teachers, it's not representative. It's very similar to saying if you have all people who have daily internet access, it's not representative. So that wasn't a requirement of race or gender or protected class. It was, we can tell all teachers is not representative, just like we can tell that everyone who has to have internet access every day, that's not representative as well.
Now you're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
So have your rebuttal. Thank you. Mr. Walsh.
May it please the court. There's a lot of issues in this case. So if you have a question that's not about e-jury, I'm happy to answer that. I'd just like to answer some of the questions about e-jury first, and then I'm happy to answer anything you want since there's so much going on in this appeal.
Let's switch over to the affirmative defense versus not an affirmative defense.
Okay.
The question I have is, on the one hand, you have a burden of proof that's established, and the burden of proof is clearly imposed on the claimant, the healthcare liability claimant, okay? But what's the interaction with the actual Good Samaritan statute and immunity?
Okay.
Because it does appear that 153 has always been in some way, shape, or form related to 151, and 151 is an immunity, which is ordinarily an affirmative defense, and McIntyre specifically said it's an affirmative defense. So why should we not consider this to have been an affirmative defense that needed to be pled?
So 151 actually says is not liable if, you know, unless they're willful and wantonly negligent, clearly creating an immunity. Whereas 153 doesn't even include any language like that. It just says, in a case arising out of the provision of emergency medical care, the standard of proof for the claimant is willful and wanton negligence. So it doesn't create a defense. It creates a burden of proof. And
is it a burden of proof interrelated to the immunity? That's my question.
Not to, because it doesn't use that language. It covers different, in theory, different providers or different people. I'm eligible for the Good Samaritan statute. The doctor may not be eligible for the Good Samaritan statute because he may do whatever care he provides in expectation of remuneration, as an example, whereas the emergency medicine statute of 153 only covers providers in the specified locations providing specified emergency medical care, which is a big difference between the two statutes. While one stemmed from the other, in essence, they carved a completely different path to protect the providers in the three locations by making it the claimant's burden of proof as opposed to setting up an immunity-type defense. Else they would have said it's an immunity. And so you can't read the statutes forcibly together that way, because then there would be a lot of redundancy between them and the fact that the legislature chose different words for 153. The second, to address the how it's ultimately irrelevant in this case, is they tried a case with the emergency medicine statute floating around there in the background and never objected to the jury charge that included the question. If that's not some sort of trial by consent or waiver of that issue, I don't know how you could do that, because if they didn't think we had pled the required affirmative defense, they should have said, hey, you can't submit that. There's no pleading on that. And then there's all the evidence that they presented to the jury about the fact that Dr. Pompa needed to ramp things up and get going because this could be a heart attack, or this could be malignant hypertension, or this could be angioedema. All those things proved that he was providing emergency medical care. In essence, they tried the issue by consent by forcing the issue to the jury. And so trying it by consent with the evidence, trying it by consent by not presenting it to the jury, and the statute's not 151, it's 153, which just requires that it arise out of emergency medical care, which if the legislature wanted that to be an affirmative defense, they could have used affirmative defense-like language as opposed to just saying it arises out of.
Okay. Let's switch gears. Let's talk about the interaction, the difference approach between Guzman and Turner.
Okay.
Guzman appears to be noticing what none of the Texas courts of appeals have actually specifically noticed, and that is that emergency medical care in the Texas statute is virtually identical to emergency medical service, no, emergency medical condition in EMTALA. Okay. In fact, the language, other than the use of the word traumatic and sudden onset, it is identical. Okay. And an earlier case said there's really no difficulty between EMTALA and Chapter 74. But on the one hand, you have all this case law that basically says that emergency medical services, because it looks at diagnosis, et cetera, as long as you're looking at the totality of the circumstances and it appears to be addressing some type of emergent condition in an emergent manner, then it meets the definition for willful and wanton. Okay. But that pretty much ignores the stability caveat hung on the end, which seems to be informed by the EMTALA statute. Okay? So tell me why I should be ignoring Guzman, other than just simply because all the other courts, including this one, have kind of said that.
Yeah, so I would say Crocker is the closest that actually looks to EMTALA-like language, because it looks to the Texas version of EMTALA and says, because the plaintiff's lawyer in that case said it's emergency services, that's defined in the Texas version of EMTALA, therefore they're the same. And the legislature, oh, no, they're not. And explicitly rejected the plaintiff's interpretation there. And while Crocker didn't exactly agree with Turner on all fronts, although it didn't really explain why it didn't agree with Turner, but if you look at the passive voice construction of the statute, right, we want the patient to be stable, is stabilized, or is capable of receiving non-emergency care. And so if it's the heart attack that's been misdiagnosed, that patient is not stable. And so that passive construction informs us that we want the patient to actually be stable regardless of who provides the stability. And then the second component of that is you're leaving out almost all of the types of emergency medical cases that would exist, because the misdiagnosed emergency is the main ground where we have liability cases. Even before the statute, they were all about whether you misdiagnosed somebody as having a heart attack or stroke or whatever their emergency condition was. And that's why the legislature, I think, carefully chose the passive construction there, because they want the patient to actually be stabilized and capable of receiving non-emergency care, as opposed to what the doctor subjectively thought. And that's why Turner comes to the conclusion that it's prospective and objective. What is the reality of what's going on? And so you have the cases like Burleson, where it's a heart attack, and I was the lawyer in Burleson, that's why I know a little bit more about that one. But it's a heart attack, and the doctor says, no, it's not. And within, you know, 12 or 14 hours, the poor lady had died. And part of the justification for how we get there is he looked at it and made the decision in the heat of the moment, in the heat of deciding what to do with the emergency. She's not having a heart attack, but she really was. And she had not been stabilized, which is why the statute still applies. Does that answer your question?
I think so. Okay. It's clear that the case law says it has to be prospective and objective, and it cannot be retrospective. In other words, we now know what the condition actually was, and we'll look at it from that context. Has there ever been a case where they have found it wasn't emergency medical services, though? Because my reading of virtually every one of them, it as long as the doctor appears to be in a good faith manner running through a differential that includes some type of emergent possibility in terms of diagnosis, that the courts have held that it applies that way.
The two federal court cases, I think, are the only two that I'm aware of. But
those are the ones who are going back over toward the EMTALA.
Correct. But there's a distinction just factually between what happened in Guzman, as an example, because in Guzman there was testimony from the doctor where he admitted, I never thought that this was an emergency patient. Whereas, like in this case and almost all the other cases, there's heart attack or stroke or something life or limb threatening on the differential diagnosis that the doctor is going about his work to rule in or rule out, and rules out, and maybe wrongly, but in the heat of deciding what the emergency is, which is the reason why we have the statute in the first place, is to give them a little slack while they're in the heat, the midst of that emergency. Guzman is different because the doctor testified, I never saw this patient as an emergency patient. That would be one distinguishing factor. In the other federal court case, which is Hawkins, I believe, versus Montague County, in that case, it's so factually bereft of what actually transpired that it's hard for me to understand, except for I know at the end of the day they missed a cancer, and cancer doesn't typically require immediate treatment and wouldn't be life or limb threatening right then and there like a heart attack or stroke, and you would have time to deal with the cancer overall. So
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So my only point is those two federal court cases are dealing with things that look like non-emergencies based on what's going on in those cases that just happen to be in the ER versus all the other cases which are dealing with heart attacks and strokes and things that are life or limb threatening. I guess testicular torsion is another popular subject in the cases.
Well, but there's a distinction between acute and chronic. Cancer would clearly be a chronic condition.
Correct.
Okay. And the sudden onset really is a subset of acuity.
Yes, it's
a temporal subset of acuity.
But I would say yes and no for an important point that I think is relevant here, because they say she had the onset of these symptoms days ago of swelling in her throat that then became angioedema over time. And I think the sudden onset modifies the condition, not modifying the care provided by the doctor. So I may have heart attack symptoms that I ignore, like it's not reported in the Burleson case, but Ms. Burleson woke up that morning with chest pain, went shopping, and then came home from shopping around noon and said, I'm having chest pain, or maybe it was 10 a.m., but she went Christmas shopping and called her husband and said, I'm still having chest pain, come get me, let's go to the hospital. So the doctor shouldn't be, or healthcare provider shouldn't be inhibited by the fact that the patient doesn't treat the condition as an emergency, even though it suddenly appeared on them, which is what happened in this case. Is the angioedema is the condition that's suddenly on her, and while it became a lot worse over the period of time, that is still what is going on with her. Or she had malignant hypertension when she presented the ER that she didn't have the day before, or she had chest pain which she didn't have the day before. These sudden onset type conditions that can be life or limb threatening is what is the distinction that the statute carves out. I'm yours. All right. Real quick on ejury, then, to see if I can hopefully use up some of my time, and then I want to talk about one other thing that I wanted to talk about, which I think is Dr. Weatherall and Dr. Pompa. But the one thing that they said is you could have the jury proportionate 60-40 based on who responded. And again, that's not what they told the trial court. They told the trial court just have it mix it 50-50 without knowing what the response percentage was. And then the second thing that I'd say about the issue here is they've made the assumption that there's a disparity based on who showed up for jury duty that day, of which there is no evidence. And that's, I think, the problem that everybody's having here is they didn't call anybody from the clerk's office to say, tell us who shows up for e-jury. Not the specific data that they were looking for in the other case, but they they could have gotten generic data of e-jury results in this percentage, non-e-jury results in this percentage. Let's compare them out to see whether there's some problem, which is why the Court of Criminal Appeals has said one statistically bad jury does not prove systematic problem. It takes a little bit more than that. Real quick on Dr. Weatherall, I would just like to say the evidence about Dr. Weatherall, and it's pretty much undisputed, is that he thought that Dr. Tan was at or nearby the hospital so that he could be there to meet the patient in the OR. When you're considering that he's dealing with this angioedema and this airway that could close off at any moment, for which there was testimony that if he wasn't going to be there in that time frame, he should have told Dr. Weatherall. And since he didn't, all this stuff that they have about Dr. Weatherall should have made these assumptions and stuff, all of that is really just arguments about why he's negligent as opposed to why he's grossly negligent. And that's the problem with their Weatherall case, is that his impression, whether it's right or wrong, was that the doctor was nearby and could respond within minutes to this emergency, or would have been told that he would have responded in minutes to this emergency. And so that's why he could not have acted with the subjective.
So you're saying his subjective belief totally excuses him from what he did. That makes him not willful and wanton. His subjective belief alone, that's your position.
Well, there are other issues in our brief.
That's just what you said here now, so I'm addressing what you said here now.
And I would say that that's a component of it, because he has to be subjectively aware and consciously disregard, and there's no evidence in the record that he knew that the doctor wasn't there, other than things like checking the board down in the surgery suite that he's never done in his career. I mean, those sorts of things are what you're talking about. But you're also looking at, he put the patient in the hands of airway experts. If they had a problem, they could have just called him back or not taken the patient.
An anesthesiologist? Airway expert? He said he had to read the package to figure out how to do this procedure. He's not exactly an expert in it, is he?
That's the urologist, the surgeon who ultimately tried to do the airway. Right.
Okay.
Dr. Weatherall's position on this is, I called the airway experts, which are the anesthesiologists, and none of them told me that there was a problem with them doing it. And so I know that they're the airway experts at the hospital, which is why I felt the patient was in.
Well, one of them said it looked like it was going to be a difficult intubation.
Right, which is why that guy wanted it done in the ER with a surgeon, which is what we arranged for a surgeon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Talk about the Guzman case, and it is exactly like what happened here. And Guzman, you just heard counsel say that situation was different because they weren't in the midst of an emergency. And the doctor admitted that he wasn't treating an emergency situation. Dr. Pompa testified at trial, and this is in the record, it's volume 12, RR129. He testified, Tamantha's condition was, quote, nothing that suggested an emergency. And the difference between this case and almost any other case that's been cited by the other side is that here a lot of things happened with this patient before Dr. Pompa saw the patient. When by the time Dr. Pompa saw this patient was stable, and there's no evidence that she wasn't. Dr. Pompa thought she was stable. She had driven herself to the hospital that day. She was judged that she could wait for an hour because, and this is even way before he saw her, Dr. Michael Bauman had read the EKG and determined that she was fine and that her care could be put off until the next shift, okay? If she weren't stable, surely he wouldn't say, I'm not going to deal with her. I'll let the next guy deal with her because I'm about to leave. You don't do that unless you've got a stable patient.
Well, but giving her an EKG is a diagnostic test for cardiac and acute cardiac problem. So how is that not within the definition of emergency medical services?
Dr. Bowman, the nurse and Dr. Bowman ordered that. Dr. Bowman looked at it. Dr. Bowman analyzed it and decided she's fine. We can wait till the next shift. So my point is, by the time Dr. Pompa is involved, okay, That's already been ordered and analyzed and determined that she's stable, that she's not in an emergency situation with respect to her heart. And that's why we can wait till the next shift to have the next set of care providers deal
with
her.
But you're not arguing that she was stable as a matter of law. You're arguing a factual sufficiency point.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So tell me why the jury couldn't have made the decision here that, in fact, it was an emergency situation, given the diagnostic treatment that was being done, okay, and given her symptomology when she came in, and taken the totality of the circumstances, including the fact that they thought, obviously, they weren't going to be discharging her unless she was stable. But
sure.
You don't just look at the discharge diagnosis, you're looking at the entirety of the situation. So how is it that a jury could not make the decision here?
Because we have to focus on Dr. Pompa. And by the time at about 10:10 a.m. that he initially began to provide care for this patient, it had already been determined that there was not an issue going on with her heart, the EKG was fine, she could wait till the next shift. Every test that had been given to her, the strep test, and she'd already had a chest x-ray performed. Chest x-ray was negative. EKG was fine. Strep test was fine. She was stable. They were just waiting. He spent 14 minutes with her, Dr. Pompa did, and he said there was nothing that suggested an emergency. So if you look at the weight of evidence from the point of view of Dr. Pompa, by the time he's there, she's stable. And there's no evidence at all that she wasn't, and he thought that she was. So subjectively and objectively, there's no evidence. It's against the great weight of evidence to say that he, Dr. Pompa, provided care that was emergency care. And I'm Dr. Weatherall, just because I have only a little bit of time, I want to say this. It is not reasonable for him to just assume that the doctor is there. And that's what the evidence was. He assumed Dr. Tan was in the hospital because surgeons usually get there early. And in a situation where you have a life or death situation, which is what he admitted, that her airway could collapse at any moment, to just assume that the surgeon is there is willful and wanton misconduct. I mean, she was at severe risk. He knew it. He said she could decompensate at any moment. He knew he had no reason to believe there was a surgeon there. He sent her into a room without a surgeon, and the exact thing that you would be fearful of happening in this situation did happen. She waited nearly an hour with no one taking a step to protect her airway. The great weight of the evidence in this situation is it's willful and wanton misconduct for Dr. Weatherall, who had responsibility for care of this patient for that entire hour, to do nothing, to make sure her airway was clear, to send her off in a situation where he was the most qualified person to deal with that situation in the hospital, and he wasn't there. And he wasn't there because he just assumed Dr. Tan was there because surgeons get there early. That is not only is that negligent, but in a situation where he recognized that this was critical and that her airway could close at any moment, willful and wanton misconduct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your case has been submitted. Thank you very much for, obviously there's a lot of issues in this case. Your briefing was very helpful. Your arguments here today were very helpful. And at this point, you are excused to go.
Thank you.